You recognize this man? Probably not. Although, if you have been to Washington, D.C. in the past few years, you probably recognize something very much associated with him. This man's name is Friedrich St. Florian, and he was the chief architect on the World War II memorial that was built just a few years ago. And you can probably tell from his name that he is not a native of the United States. He is someone who immigrated here and became a citizen. Now, I came across a couple of his quotes that I thought were so interesting. He said, "I really feel my life is a continuation of the American dream. The immigrant who comes to this country and is allowed to excel. How many other countries would allow me to do that?" He came from Austria, came to the United States. He said this as well, "I was born in an enemy country. Only in America can someone who came from that beginning do what I'm doing." I think probably that makes all of us feel good. But I want to say this, as good as that feeling may be, for a man who comes from what he calls an enemy country to the United States to live out his dream, how much better of an opportunity is given for all of mankind not to have a change in citizenship from this country to another country, but to have the change of citizenship from this world to another world? Last week, we introduced the idea of being exiles, elect exiles, as Peter tells us, that we are pilgrims and sojourners in this land, that we have been born to a new kingdom, to a new country. And I want us to think about, as amazing as that is, the responsibilities that also go along with it. That being given this great privilege and this great honor by God to be taken from a life that's destined for death and destruction, and put into a life that's destined for eternity, how great that is, and how great a responsibility that places on us. So this morning, I want us to talk about being peculiar pilgrims. These people who are exiles, elected by God, but nonetheless, who are destined for better and for different things than what this life has to offer. Last week, we talked about how that, in many ways, Christ has set the stage for us. And we need to remember that. That you think about a man like St. Florian, who is a naturalized citizen. That's not what you and I do. He went through the paperwork. He went through all of the process. But yet, it was within his ability to do that. What you and I must see is that in and of ourselves and on our own, there was no way for this change of citizenship. There was no way to become a pilgrim on this earth while a citizen in a different land. That was a cost that was unavailable for us to pay. So who took care of that for us? Well, we know that, don't we? It was the one who was the ultimate exile. It was the one who left heaven itself, who came to this earth, who died on the cross and ascended back into heaven to prepare the way for us. He's the one who paid the cost. I want you to consider what the Apostle Paul had to say on this to the Ephesians. He said, "For he," talking about Christ, "is our peace, who has made us both one and has broken down in his flesh the dividing wall of hostility by abolishing the law of commandments expressed in ordinances, that he might create himself one new man in place of the two, so making peace, and might reconcile us both to God in one body through the cross, thereby killing the hostility. And he came and preached peace to you who were far off, and peace to those who were near, for through him we both have access in one spirit to the Father. So then, you are no longer strangers and aliens," talking of that heavenly land, "but you are fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Christ Jesus himself being the cornerstone, in whom the whole structure being joined together grows into a holy temple in the Lord. In him you also are being built together into a dwelling place for God by the Spirit." Isn't that an amazing passage? Here Paul, as he oftentimes does, will approach an idea from two or three different ways. And he talks about being built into this structure, but he also talks about our concept.
of being exiles in this land, but approaches it a bit differently, doesn't it? He says we are no longer strangers and aliens from the heavenly realm, from the land to which we're seeking to go, that we are citizens there.
As we think about our thoughts on elect exiles, much of what we're doing is looking at what Peter had to say about that. And so building on what we read here from the Apostle Paul, I want you to consider what Peter has to say and encourage you to go ahead and open your Bibles on up to 1 Peter. We'll be looking in chapters 1 and 2 primarily in the lesson this morning. And I want you to see what he has to say about this ultimate exile, Jesus Christ, and the price that he paid for us. If you look in chapter 1, verse 18. Peter says, knowing that you were ransomed from the futile ways inherited from your forefathers, not with perishable things as with silver and gold. Peter, as so many of the New Testament writers tell us, is this: you have no way out of bondage except through Jesus Christ. That's why Jesus himself said, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life, I am the door, I am the vine. No man is going to find his way to the Father or to that heavenly citizenship without Jesus Christ. And Peter echoes that idea. He is the only way out of bondage. But note what else he says. He said to get us out of bondage, he had to pay the ultimate price. Verse 19, but with the precious blood of Christ, like that of a lamb, as we sang this morning. Our position here on earth, biblically, is looked upon as a place of bondage. That when you and I are not in Jesus Christ, we are under the control of Satan himself. We are a slave to him. And Peter says, Jesus Christ is the only way out, and to ransom you, to get you out of this bondage, he paid the price no one else could do. And why was he the only one he could do it? Well, look at the end of verse 19. Like that of a lamb without spot or blemish. Perfect. The sacrifice who came and died for us so that we could find our way to escape from the bondage of Satan and wickedness. And Peter then says, and what should be so important to us, he was foreknown before the foundation of the world, but was made manifest in this last time for the sake of you. Peter says, we're not talking theory here. We're not talking some theoretical idea. We are talking about Jesus Christ giving his life on the cross for you and I, so that we could find this salvation. Now, with that as our preface, I want you to look over to chapter 2 and verse 10. He says, once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. When we see what has been done for us by God's grace and mercy, and in faith and trust, we take God up on that offer for a change of citizenship, to become citizens of that heavenly land, Peter says, you are now God's people. That's a great thought. But it's also a very sobering thought. That in the fact that you and I are God's people, it means that there is a responsibility on us to live like His people. That we are not taking God and letting Him do all of this, and in return we give nothing to Him. Peter is saying there must be a very major change in the way you live your life. And he tells the people to whom he's writing, and he tells us that we are now a people for his own possession. If you're looking in the King James Version, you're going to see there that it says you are a peculiar people. I like that phrase. I know why the change has been made, and it's because the word peculiar has changed meanings over the years. When in modern language we talk about someone being peculiar, we talk about them being odd or strange. We might say he's kind of curious, he's kind of peculiar.
But originally, what that term meant is that it was something distinctive. It was something about you that nobody else had. It was peculiar to you. And so Peter is saying here, when you take the Lord's grand offer to become a part of His people, you become peculiar to Him. You are set apart to Him. You are His and belong to His ways. Now, what does that mean for us? That as we look at what God has told us that we are, what that means is that if we have a change in citizenship, then we have a change in behavior. We don't act the way we used to. We don't think the way we used to. We don't behave ourselves in the way that we used to. We are now peculiar to God. We are illustrating and demonstrating in our lives what's peculiar even to Him and that holiness. And when you and I realize that, it means that we leave slavery behind. And we are no longer slaves to these passions of life. Look in chapter 1 in verse 14. He says, as obedient children, do not be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance. And that should say 2:11. Look over to verse 11 of chapter 2 when he says, beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of this flesh, which wage war against your souls. We are not governed by the moral blindness that we had before Jesus Christ. Isn't it amazing to look at how society thinks? And as the distinction between Christian and non-Christian grows ever wider in our culture, as we hear people talk and we listen to their reasoning, we see the moral blindness of it. Peter says, you're no longer governed by that. Those passions are no longer there. Because you are a people who are peculiar to God. You're a people who are set apart for His own purpose and His own possession. And He's going to go further to say, and that's why you are holy as God is holy. Let's continue on. We read verse 14, but look at verse 15. When He says, but as He who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct. Since it is written, you shall be holy, for I am holy. Are we understanding what God is telling us there? That holiness is our peculiarity? It's what's setting us apart to Him because He's set apart by that? That we are a people who in holiness, not only by the confession that we make of Him, but also by our actions, are demonstrating what He's like? That's what it means to be His possession. That's what it means to be holy as He is holy. Look at the language. As obedient children, conduct yourselves. As much as we might hate to admit it sometimes, our children are a reflection of us. That as we look, especially as they're in our household, their behaviors, their attitudes, that reflects on us. And Peter uses that same argument with God. He's saying, you are God's children. He is your Father. Therefore, as obedient children, conduct yourself to His honor, to His glory. And he takes that one step further, and he says, because Father is watching. Notice what he says here. When he says in verse 17, and if you call on Him as Father who judges impartially according to each one's deeds, conduct yourself with fear through the time of your exile. God is to be approached with absolute respect and reverence. We cannot say, well, God's my Father. He'll overlook this. He loves His children. No. Familiarity must never breed contempt for holiness. To say, well, I'm a Christian, I'm a child of God, I can do whatever I want now. Peter is saying, God is an impartial God. And if he looks on those who have made a commitment, at least verbally, to be his children, and they don't do it, they'll be judged in fairness. They'll be judged with impartiality. So that means that we behave ourselves. That as his children, that as citizens of his kingdom, that as his people, we are a people who are peculiar to him. The Apostle Peter, as he writes in verse 9, goes back to the history of Israel. And he pulls out some thoughts and terms that God had used to associate with the people of Israel to talk about those that he now has, his chosen people, his peculiar people. And as he uses these, one of the terms that he says concerning Christians is this: you are a chosen race. He says that to us, to people who through faith in God, through the waters of baptism, have become a part of his family, that we are a chosen race. You look through the sordid history of mankind, and race has always been a rather thorny issue, hasn't it? Because there are people who try to make themselves feel better because they were born into a particular race. I suppose in more modern times, the most notorious example of this would be Adolf Hitler in Germany, where he said whatever the Aryan race was in his mind, that's the superior race and we're going to eliminate everybody who doesn't meet that. Well, that's horrible. Anytime we see that kind of racism, that is something unjustified by God, something totally unlike God. But let me assure you, when the Apostle Peter says you are a chosen race, that in no way is a racist statement. Because there is nothing you and I could possibly do to ever earn our place into this race. It is only by the grace of God. Peter says you're chosen by him. And he draws that phrase from Isaiah. As Isaiah was talking about the children of Israel, though set in a rather negative time of their history, he says, the wild beast will honor me, the jackals and the ostriches, for I give water in the wilderness, rivers in the desert, I give drink to my chosen people. You see, just like Israel was God's chosen people, so are we. Did Israel do anything to deserve that? Nothing. Did you and I do anything to deserve that? Nothing. In fact, just the opposite. But God in His mercy has said, I invite you to become a part of this chosen race. And when I accept that invitation, it means that I'm very serious about purity. That as I look at my place now in the family of God, in this generation, as some translations say, or this race, that I am keenly aware that my actions and my attitudes must be governed by purity. You ever notice how often Peter talks about that in this section we're looking at this morning? You think about in chapter 2 and verse 2, he says, like newborn infants, long for the spiritual milk that you may grow into the way of salvation. You know, sometimes, such as in the book of Hebrews, the idea of taking milk is contrasted with the meat of the word. That's not the case here. Here, milk is being viewed as the nourishment, as what's needed for life to become what God desires of this chosen race. And so Peter says, if you belong to this race, you long for that spiritual nourishment just as a newborn longs for the nourishment of milk. But it's purity. It's not something different. It's not man's take on things. It's not my take on things. It's what God has said. And when I'm nourished on that, Peter says in chapter 1, verse 22, that I'm going to have a purified soul. Notice how I get that. Having purified your souls by your obedience to the truth. It's not just knowing. It's doing. It's not just saying. It's acting. And thus, when I am carrying out my desire is to feast on that spiritual nourishment in its purity, my soul is going to be purified. And he goes on in this verse to say, and when your soul is purified, so is your heart. Having purified your souls by your obedience to the truth, for a sincere brotherly love, love one another earnestly from a pure heart. That's what it means to be a chosen race. That it's not by bloodline or genetics that we're finding purity. It's by the pure Word of God. By a God who can make us pure. A God who can purify those ill motives and make us what He desires. Peter goes on. And he says, you're a peculiar people. You're a chosen race. But he also says you are a holy nation. Set apart. Sanctified as a people of God. That idea of nationhood has a wide variety of meanings. When you study about a nation in an earthly sense, it's established. It's got citizenship. Got laws. But one thing in particular that I want us to bring out that Peter brings out in this section is that when you are a part of a holy nation, you have responsibilities to the other citizens of that nation. You have a place and you look for their needs and you take care of them. You know, even in an earthly sense, we do this, don't we? The very poorest of our society, we see care being given for them. What a greater thought to think about this holy nation. That all of those who have been baptized into the name of Jesus Christ are now citizens. And citizens who look out for one another. What did we just read about that in verse 22 of chapter 1? He says, you are loving one another. That as fellow citizens, your love is paramount. Let's look just one more time. Where he says here, having purified your souls by your obedience to the truth for a sincere brotherly love, love one another earnestly. Look at those words, sincere. No phoniness, no hypocrisy. Here is something that is genuine and true. And here is a test of whether or not I am that people of God's own possession, that peculiar pilgrim. Because it means I've put away the things of this world. I don't act like that anymore. Look on down to verse 1 of chapter 2, where he says, so put away all malice and all deceit and hypocrisy and envy and all slander. Those are the characteristics of this life. That's how people of this world behave. But you see, I'm not defined by malice. I don't have ill will for another. I don't have ill will for my brethren. I'm going to do nothing to destroy this relationship that I have with them. I'm not going to play the double agent here. I'm not going to be deceptive or hypocritical. I'm not acting with ulterior motives, perhaps to try to act all friendly towards someone just to set them up for a fall. That's not me anymore. He says as well, I'm not going to envy others. That's almost an unbelievable thought, but yet how often do we see brethren envying other brethren? Maybe here's one preacher who's well-liked and another maybe who's not so liked. Maybe here's an elder who just responds better to the congregation than another elder. Here's a member who is just so liked by everyone and another member who maybe struggles with that. We ought to be glorying in those things. If there's another man who can preach a message better than me, preach on. If there's an elder who can be more of an influence than maybe another elder, be that influence. If here's a brother who is good and able to make friends and deal well with others, pray for him that that's going to lead to good things because you see, I've put envy away. That's not in my toolbox anymore. Nor is slander. Tearing someone down who I think is my rival. I can't behave like that anymore. I'm part of a holy nation. I'm with a group of people who've been set apart for better things than that. And thus, I don't act like the people of this world of whom I used to be. These are the characteristics of the unpurified, not the purified soul. You are a chosen race. You are a holy nation. You are a royal priesthood. This to me is so interesting. Two times in this section that we're looking at this morning, Peter uses the concept of priesthood. The first of those is over in chapter 2 and verse 5, where he talks about a holy priesthood. You note here, you yourselves like living stones being built up as a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. I think Peter is calling on us to think about the shadows of the Levitical priesthood here. That just as there were Levitical priests who were consecrated and set apart for a special duty, so are we. We have a place in this. And as well, he says, you're set apart to offer these spiritual sacrifices. If you're like me, one passage immediately comes to mind when you read that. You think about Romans chapter 12 and verse 1, I appeal to you, brothers, what? By the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, a spiritual sacrifice, for spiritual worship. Just as that priest was offering this sacrifice before God, so I offer myself to God. I think as well about Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 15. Through Him then let us continually offer up a sacrifice of praise to God, that is, the fruit of the lips that acknowledge His name. We're set apart. We're consecrated. We're offering sacrifices. But let's talk about this concept of a royal priesthood. Because that was a term that was applied not just to the Levites. That was a term applied to all of Israel as a group, as a nation. They were called God's royal priesthood because they were His priests to the other nations. That just as the Levitical priesthood was in a sense the go-between between Israel and God, Israel was in a sense to be the go-between with these other nations and God to bring them to Him. Such an interesting study of where God in Genesis talks about the nations and then begins unfolding how He wanted Israel to bring those nations to Him, but they failed. And so that duty is now ours. That we are to be priests to those who are on the outside, to go and to bring them in. That's our focus on evangelism. That's why we spend time talking about the need to share our faith with others, to explain the gospel message to others, because we're seeking to bring them in. But let me put this in another context that Peter uses. We've got to be very aware that that's also done a great deal by our example. Look at verse 12. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles. I don't know that we'd be out of line to say nations here. Among the Gentiles, honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. They can see how you behave. They can see how you're acting. And they can say, I want to be a part of that. This is the example set by the peculiar pilgrim. This is the example of one who is a royal priest and a member of a holy nation, and a part of a chosen race, a peculiar possession of the Lord. But after all of this, let me make one final point. Let's not at all be deceived that the world is not going to like us too much for this. While there will be some who will come and want this, there will be others who are ready for battle. Pilgrims, exiles, often find themselves in that situation. They often find enemies. Peter's listed two here, hasn't he? He said there are those who are opposed to God. That's who we just read here. Those who are against Him. But back up one verse and there's something a whole lot closer to home than that, isn't there? He says in verse 11, Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of this flesh, which wage war against your soul. What we're surrounded with is warring against us. The TV programs, the movies, the billboards, the internet. Those are things that are appealing to the passions of this flesh, and it's warring against us as God's peculiar people. So what do we do? Look over to chapter 1, verse 13. Here is the pilgrim warrior's mind. Therefore, preparing your minds for action. But let's change that to the King James. Therefore, gird up the loins of your mind, and being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Here's how we fight the passions of this life. Here's how we fight those who would seek to bring us down because of our place as God's peculiar pilgrims. First of all, we gird up the loins of our mind. We know what that means. In the old days, when you had those long shirts that you would wear under your outer garment, they were fine for working, but if you needed to get somewhere quickly, they'd trip you up in a hurry. So you girded them up and you ran. Peter says, gird up the loins of your mind. Those things that are going to trip you up, those things that are going to destroy you, get rid of them. Don't let them hinder your service. And he says, you better be sober about what you're doing. You see, being a peculiar pilgrim is serious business. Someone who's half-hearted into it is not a peculiar pilgrim. Someone who says, I really don't have a lot of interest in this, except maybe just a little, they're not sober about it. You see, the sober-minded pilgrim judges everything by the standard of God. The words, the actions, the thoughts, the behaviors. It's all by God's standard. And the pilgrim is focused. We don't so much do this anymore, but it used to be back in the old country, when people would go to battle, what would they say? For king and country. So no matter where they were in the world, what were they thinking of? They were thinking of home. I'm fighting for the homeland. I'm fighting for the leader. That's us. You see, we're exiles here. We're pilgrims here. And we're being attacked because of who we are, because of our homeland, because of our king. And so when the fight is brought to us, we stay focused on that. Because I assure you, the minute we take our eyes, spiritually speaking, off of heaven, the battle is lost. And we'll see no need to distinguish ourselves on this life. And as a soldier, we remain fixed on Jesus Christ. His life is my life. His example is my example. The battles He wage, I wage. The things He said, I say. And when I can have these four characteristics in my mind, in my heart, in my actions, I'll be that peculiar pilgrim God desires. I'll be that elect exile who by the grace of God has been given an opportunity to abandon the bondage of this world and to begin that journey for the homeland. So it boils down then to just simply asking, each of us asking this, am I that peculiar pilgrim? Am I someone who is different and set apart, illustrating the ways of God as God's special people?